Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The Science of Sport podcast with sports editor Mike Finch and sports scientist Professor Ross Tucker.
I always love an interview with an elite athlete because it gives you perspective that you can never get from anybody else. And we really wanted to get into the weeds of this particular person's sport to find out how they race, they train, how they think about the racing itself, the different things that have helped them in their ability to train, etc., etc. So our guest today is Marcel Guerini, who is fifth place. He was fifth place in the World Championships in mountain biking last year. He's got... In fact, 2 years ago. And then last year, finished third, finished in the top five three times in World Cups. And then with a chance this year, hopefully, if things go well for him, of representing Switzerland at the Paris Olympics, along with people like Nina Schurter. So Marcel is a guy who knows a lot about mountain biking. At 29 years of age, the questions that he asked, I know Ross of him have been in contact for a while, talking about the various science. So he's a guy, not only does he want to perform at his best, but he's also a man who embraces a lot of the science, looks at the research himself, and tries to find the best way to be the best version of himself in terms of mountain biking. So as you'll hear in this discussion, he really does open up about a lot of the things that he has to deal with as a professional athlete. We ask him some intriguing questions about his psychology and those sort of things, which he kind of answers in a very particularly Swiss sort of way. But the content of this I find absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, he's an interesting, I mean, I'm not exactly inundated with elite athletes on social media, following us, but he's definitely the most vocal, and every once in a while, actually sometimes fairly frequently, he'll send a link to an article that he read, not just an article on a sort of garbagey news site, but actually a scientific paper. And so he's obviously put himself in the flow of scientific conversation in order to look for what might then work best. And you'll hear in the conversation, he's got quite a good grasp of the scientific principles that underpin the training. And sitting here now, I can't even remember, like there was some stuff that we spoke about while we were recording. And then as usual, some of the stuff after the recording was really good. And I don't remember whether he actually told us that he's the kind of guy who needs to know why he's doing stuff. Mm-hmm. It's part of his makeup. He wants to know, like, if I'm going to go and do a high intensity session or a long ride or whatever it is, or if I'm going to change my nutrition, I'll do it, but I want to understand it before I do it well. And so that's kind of drives his interest in the science. And yeah, he's academic. He's an academic mountain biker, is how I would put it, with like a high level of curiosity and insight as a consequence of that curiosity. So it was really a pleasure to talk to him. And like I say, it's a said some things afterwards, you know, like that I wish we'd captured. But
always press record. I must remember that.
Yeah, but are definitely things we're going to bank, because you'll hear from him now. He's visited South Africa a lot and will continue to visit. And in future, when he's here with other people with the Swiss mountain biking team, we're going to try and get those people on also and explore some of the little teasers that he left us with. So, wonderful start to 2024.
Well, here he is. If you're interested in the world of high-performance mountain biking or any kind of high-performance sport, this is a very interesting interview with one of the best in the world.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So Marcel, welcome to The Science of Sports. It's always a great privilege to have a professional sportsman in our podcast because it gives us an insight that we as amateur sportsmen never get. And I'm sure for a lot of our people who listen to this podcast, it's an opportunity for us to ask you questions. And I literally have probably 20 questions that I've always wanted to ask a pro mountain biker. So I'm not sure I'm going to get to all of those because I'm sure Ross has a lot of them himself. But let's kick it off by... You're here in Cape Town. Why are you here in Cape Town? What are you doing here? How long have you been in Cape Town for? What's your Cape Town place now? What do you do here?
Yeah, I'm enjoying the nice weather. No, I mean, I'm coming to Stellenbosch now for over 12 years. Firstly, for sure, for the training. It's perfect conditions for mountain biking. Always good weather. No jet lag, so it's perfect for me to come down here.
So what time of the season is this for you? In other words, what is most of your training now? Is it long base miles? Is it more peak stuff? What do you do in Stellenbosch at this time of year?
Yeah, I just started with training again. I had off in November and now slowly back to training, so more long hours. But I also started with intensity as well, so I do intensity, I mean, almost the whole year, so a mix of both, I would say.
Because the interesting thing about being a pro mountain biker, and particularly when you're racing World Cups, you've got a World Championship every single year, and this year in 2024 you've got a Olympic Games, which is happening as well. So how do you, when you talk about, for instance, runners who have phases they go through, they can run two, maybe three marathons a year, you're having to peak for 6 months of the year. How do you do that? Are you always on peak form for that 6 months?
No, I mean, now I'm quite heavy.
I can tell you.
No, I'm not in top shape, far away. But yeah, it's a challenge, but I think our season now starts a little bit earlier. It's middle of March till October, but this year we also had a nice summer break without like 6 weeks without races. So you can have a quick rest, like 3-4 days off, and then rebuild again for the second half of the season, which is really helpful. So it's not like 6 months straight. You need to be in top shape, which helps.
So when you say you got 6 weeks off, I mean, 3 or 4 days doesn't seem like much of a rest because I've had 3 or 4 days off the bike this week. But when you say you have a rest and then you build again, what do you mean you build again? In other words, you start with base work and then go into intensity, or do you just have 3 or 4 days rest and then keep going with the same program as you did a week before?
No, I mean, it's a bit different from the summer break. I mean, that's the middle of the season. You just have like 6 weeks, no races. So you do maybe 3 days off and then you start quite fast with the normal program. But now in November I did 2 weeks nothing, like, or even more, and then you start slowly progression, some long hours and then some intensity. Mm-hmm. So it's like that. Yeah,
I think it's fair to say, and I don't know whether this is even true in your career, because and I'd like to actually in a moment go back to how you got to where you are now. But it's fair to say that in the last 10, 20 years, there's been a small and I think subtle but important shift in how seasons are structured, in the sense that the classic model was, here's a base block. All I do is low intensity, long distance mileage. And then I have a transition block and then I have an intensity. I don't think it works that way anymore. It's not so neat as like, here's a green, here's an amber, here's a red. You know what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
Like you alluded to it now. You're pretty much doing some intensity stimulus throughout the year because you're always quite close to your best. Like not just to the point where you're a week from being at peak, but you're not deconditioned or totally differently conditioned for like weeks at a time, and then you switch on and then you switch off, then you switch on. You're kind of always simmering and just trying to boil at the right point. You know what I mean? And that's true in running, I think in swimming, and I suspect in cycling. So I don't know whether the way you train now, 2023, is different to how you maybe were training in 2017.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's totally right what you said. It's, yeah, you start with intensity quite fast, or I do. Like after one week back, I start to do some intensity, not as much or as long as I would do in the middle of the season, but I start quite fast with it, and I think it helps you to get back to to a certain point. And I think it's a good switch.
Yeah, so it's simmering. I mean, the way you describe it, simmering is actually quite a good way of doing it. Yeah,
because you want to be permanently like at almost boiling point, enough that then when the main objectives of the season, Olympics next year, World Champions in a normal year, or that block of four World Cups leading into a World Champs, whatever, then you just want to be able to switch it up in two more degrees so that you start the boil, you know? But you can't do that too early because then you boil dry. But you don't want to be so far below that that you can't get there. So that's the delicate balance. And it's definitely evolved. This classic periodization model where you had these very discrete but separate silos is no longer really used by many people.
And you think that's just relevant in cycling, or is it happening?
No, it's definitely the case. So I remember Alex Popov now. I remember, this is the swimmer, right? He was in 92, 96 Olympics. Yeah. His coach used to say Popov's always 2 weeks away from a world record. He's nowhere close to it. Like, he wouldn't do it now, but in 2 weeks I'll have him there. Not like cyclist in January saying, please, you know, I'm 6 months away from my best. It's not like that anymore. I think you pretty much have to be a year-round athlete. But the subtle difference is you just, it's so delicate, that ecosystem. Yeah, I mean, you overdo it in 1 month of the year, it's too much. You underdo it, it's too little.
Yeah. And I think it also helps you, or it prepares you to train the load. Like, if you never do, let's say, 4x8 minute interval in winter, and then suddenly you have to do it, it's such a big task for the body. And if you go with smaller steps to that 4x8 minutes, it also helps you to prepare it. And I think that's also a reason.
Yeah, because otherwise the transition from the low intensity to the medium to the high, the steps are too big, you know? And then you've got to manage an overtraining risk at the very moment you're trying to ramp up, which you're doing anyway, but it's how much of it are you willing to accept? So that's interesting. So that's the session then. Is it 4x8? Is that kind of like your staple at the moment, intensity session?
Not at the moment, but that's like during the season, one of my intensity sessions, 4x8 minute at VO2 max. It's
VO2 max power.
Yeah.
What's the differentiation between VO2 max and VO2 max power?
Well, you don't know VO2 on the bike, right?
Yeah.
Like, you're not measuring it. So
you're working out what your power is on the bike.
It would have been tested in the lab, and you'd say, right, at VO2 max, this is my power. And then on the bike, I'm going to ride that power.
Yeah.
Basically, all it means is I'm at a very, very top end of my limit for 8 minutes at a time. That's a hard session.
And how do you the same? When you do a session like that, are you doing the same climb and then judging your performance on the climb so that it's the same time every time, or the same distance over that eight minutes?
Yeah, firstly I look on power only, power, and then sometimes also heart rate a little bit.
You just could also do VO2 heart rate, but
power only, and then you see with the distance how you go. And it's also, I think, a main difference from now to the peak, it's also like the body weight. Now you have 2-4 kilos more, and then you will drop it down. That's also something that's different during this time now of the year.
So you think, so you're heavier now?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, at least 3-4 kilos heavier.
And I know the listeners can't see, but you're a small guy compared. You feel like giants around you, but you must be very thin. Yeah. I mean, when you do that sort of session, can you give us some numbers? What are you looking at in terms of your watts when you do that 4x8 minutes?
Like, I would say around 400 watts.
So you can hold 400 watts for 8 minutes at a time.
Like my bests, I think it's 4x8 minutes with 420 watts, and it's like 67 kilos around that. That's like but it's also with experience, you know, when you can do it, then you know you have a good shape. That's also... Yeah.
So Ross, work that out for us quickly. 420 watts.
70 would be 420 at 6. So 67 would be 6.2 watts per kilo.
Okay.
Yeah. Sure.
But there is also with that, I texted Ross once about it, with that whole power stuff. I mean, with the power meter, every power meter is different. Like, we can measure it how accurate it is, in our labs, but there it's huge difference from 1% too high to 20% and 3% too low. So if a guy says 400 watts, doesn't mean your power meter is the same. Like it's difficult to compare. So I never compare with other guys.
So when you're doing your sessions, you're basing on the power meter you're using on that bike rather than what your lab test might say.
I know
it might be different.
Yeah, I know my power meter. I know how accurate it is. I tested it and I use only this one, so I can compare it to myself only.
Yeah.
And if a guy says, "Yeah, I'm doing 4x8 minutes with 500 watts," yeah, I don't know if it's 5% too high or something else, but. Mm. What's for sure, no power meter is 100% accurate.
Sure.
No problem. Yeah.
And tell me then, that as you get closer to race season, does the interval session change to shorter blocks but more frequent at higher power outputs?
No, this year I only did that 8 minutes, and then I also did some like criteriums, like it's like race simulation kind of. Which like the short sprints and stuff.
Yeah.
So, or a classic one would be interval session would be 30-15, like 30 seconds sprint, 15 seconds break for like 10 minutes, three times. That's also, I think, a common one.
Mm.
But you do that closer to race season than now in winter, because it's quite intense.
Mm.
Because mountain biking by its nature, and we often talked about this in the podcast, if you look at road cyclists can cruise along for 5 hours in a bunch and at a heart rate that's super low, but they can accelerate and they can do 800 watts, 1,000 watts, some of the sprinters at short intervals. That's the difference between amateurs and pros. On mountain biking, when you watch it on television, it's a case of like these short, intense sessions of effort, and then there's a downhill, and then there's another short, intense session of uphill. So there's never consistent power. There's this continuous shift in power all the time. And is that, do you train specifically for that continuous shift of power that you have?
I think it looks like that from the outside, but actually in the race, it's more like if you can race a steady high power, you will be at the front. Like, I think that's something that everybody thinks from the outside. It's like stop and go, but it's not really like that. I think the downhills are so short, and then when you try to sprint the next uphill, it's not gonna work. So I think if you have a steady high power at the end, you will be at the front.
That's interesting. So in other words, you're not accelerating into climbs. You're just keeping that consistent high power.
Not really, like just a high power. But maybe that's also my type of how I race.
Mm.
I'm really consistent, like with lap times and everything. So I can do a really, really high pace for 90 minutes.
Mm.
But I'm not the guy that's like sprinting out of corners and like cyclocross guys. That's more like sprinting out of corners, going down, up.
Mm. So give us an idea then, in a race, what would the average power output and the normalized power output be?
I really don't
know.
So
depending on course,
I never use meter because of the of weight actually only.
Okay.
And I did earlier, like 2 or 3 years ago, but I never could take something out for me that helped me in training afterwards, because every race is different.
Mm. Mm.
So I can't tell you actually.
Interesting.
Yeah. Hmm. So when I look at mountain biking and I hear what you're saying about this consistent power output, but when you see some of those close-ups when you're going up a technical section and there's that real set where the guys, you can see they're really battling to get over roots and that sort of thing, it seems like the intensity there is like flat out. But even in that situation, you're saying it's more about consistent power rather than just trying to accelerate up that climb. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, Yeah, if it's the last lap, last climb, you go all in. That's for sure. But if it's second, third lap, you sometimes need to be smart and not waste a lot of energy in that small section and see the whole race. And what I also think it's really important is to be efficient. That's efficiency. It's really important. That's some of the really, really top guys, like Nino, is so efficient on the bike. When you look at him in the technical section, he's not losing any speed or not wasting power. And that's also that small difference at the end.
Mm. Describe a race, because for us who are watching it, it seems intense for the first half lap, kind of levels off a little bit. Then there's this lull. And then there's the acceleration towards it feels like a lull. Because when you watch it, it feels like it. Everybody gets into position and it stays like it for a while. And then towards the last third of the race, suddenly there's lots of changes. Is that how it works? I mean, you've got three top fives in 2023, two of them in the top three. How do you race it? And what does the race look like? How does the intensity happen?
I think it's so different from racing at a really, really top in the front. Or if you're battling between top 10, top 20, there is like a fight from the beginning till the end, positioning. It's like you're fighting for every centimeters. And the further you go to the front, there is more. Actually, it's more quiet. It sounds stupid, but it's quite more quiet. Like, it's maybe also more respect between the guys and some tactics. And it's easier to race in the front. You don't have that fighting maybe in the last one or two laps. But yeah, if you start at the 20th, 30th, I mean, the first minutes are really intense. You go all in. You try to. You need to be smart. You know, I'm always trying to hold my position and not spending that much energy to pass one or two guys, because in the first one or two laps, from the first to the 40th guy, everybody's the same. Mm. Like, there's no difference. Everybody's strong, so it would cost you so much energy to pass somebody at that in the beginning of a race. So I wait maybe one lap, one and a half lap, and then I, with my steady power, with the speed, I go further and further up. And then after two or three laps, there is no actually fighting anymore when you pass a guy, because you're so much faster. It makes no sense for them to hold against it. So, but you need to be patient.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, growing up in you know, being a Swiss rider, there's a huge amount of pressure, because, you know, Swiss mountain bikers are legendary. It's like Kenyan runners. You know, you guys own mountain biking to some extent. Because you grew up in that system, do you think there is race knowledge that has been passed down from people like Nino Schurter and guys like Lars Forster and, of course, yourself now, that goes down, it filters through the system where you kind of, your knowledge about the way that you race, because that insight you're giving us about how you race is interesting, because it's not how I thought it happened. Is it part of the Swiss system, or is it just stuff that you've learned yourself through racing?
I think that one I learned by myself, but I think with that whole Swiss, being Swiss and it's so difficult, the positive things is like the competition in the team. Like, yeah, you're growing up and you never be the best, or you always have somebody that's better than you and you want to beat this guy. And that's like a competition and a motivation, which when you're the only guy in your country and you think you're the best, and then you go out to the world and then
you're not.
Yeah, you're not. That's something else. So I think that's why so many Swiss guys are good, actually, I think.
Because the whole Swiss setup is good.
Yeah, the Swiss setup is good, and there's like always somebody that's even better than you, and you want to be as good as this guy, and that's giving competition and motivation. And yeah, you're searching for that small detail to make better. So I think it's not only negative to be like Swiss in like for Worlds or Olympics, but it gives you also a lot of positive things.
And when did you realize that you were as good as, or could be as good as, a guy like Nino? I mean, he's obviously a legend in your sport and in your country, but now you're racing with him, and you have been close to him, I'd imagine, over the last couple of years. when did you think, hang on a minute, I'm actually racing with a guy who is a legend and I could beat him on a good day? When did that happen?
I'm not sure. Like 2016, I lost on a 23-year where I was finished. I think I won a World Cup in on a 23. I finished third on the at Worlds, Europeans. And then I, yeah, you know, when you in that age, you can be one of the top guys, you can have a chance in the elite rankings. But it was never the goal to like especially beat like Nino. It's more like, yeah, I mean, he's a legend in the sport and you look up to him and try to, let's say, yeah, look what he does and how he's riding, and generally it's not I don't want to beat him, I just want to win races, and then therefore you need to beat him anyway, so but it's not against one guy, that's yeah.
So you've looked, I mean, obviously you've got, you know, people know how he trains, and as you've said, you're describing how he races, he's super efficient. So do you take tips from him? In other words, do you know, okay, I think Nina does this or Nina does that, maybe we can take some learnings out of that? Or is it, okay, I'm finding my own way?
I mean, in that sport, nobody gives you free advice.
Not even Nina to his fellow countrymen.
I mean, you try, there is some certain ways to train efficiency, like you do small technical loops, and you do that 5-6 times and then you change to another other one, so you can train that, so yeah, you don't need him to ask.
What percentage of your training is done alone as opposed to with other riders who are similar level to you?
Yeah, in Stellenbosch it's I think 100%. But at home, yeah, luckily I stay close to all other really good guys. Like one is retired now, but the other guy is Matthias Flückiger. I mean, he was second at the Olympics, and yeah, he's also one of the very best guys. And he's especially technique, he's really, really good. So when I go with him on the mountain bike, I'm always under pressure, and it helps me at the end because I don't want that he drops me in the downhill, and then yeah, you adjust your riding, and that's definitely something that's really cool.
Do you ever have fear in a course about falling?
Ross is sitting here with lots of grazes on his body from a crash.
Like, is there ever fear? Because and actually on that, how does it work when you go to a course? Do you get to see it on the Wednesday walkthroughs, ride it Thursday, or how do they let you learn the technical elements of the course?
Yeah, like to come back to your first question, fear, I think it's not fear, it's more respect sometimes when you don't know the course. Like, let's say this year at Worlds in Glasgow, it was a brand new course, and then first day I didn't go on the track, and some of the junior girls came back, everybody with bruises and crash and like stitches like you, and then you also have some thoughts like what's going on, there is a big chomps and stuff. But then at the end, if you see it, yeah, I think respect to do it, but yeah, we are so good technically, so every track should be rideable.
What's the most technical track on the World Cup circuit?
I think still Mont Saint-Anne in Canada, especially this year when it was wet. Like, we had a lot of running and a
lot of roots, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a good one. So this one is with big stones, and yeah, it gets slippery, so it's quite technical.
Do you like the technical stuff?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think it suits me. But I don't mind like to have also a less technical one.
And I mean, do you do technical training? I mean, do you go out there sometimes and go down a downhill black track on your XC bike and try and master that? I mean, is it always upping your skill level?
Yeah, you do. We started to do some smaller laps, like let's say 2 minute laps, technical one, and you do it 5, 6, 10 times in a row. That's like the technical training we do.
On a very technical section of a course.
Yeah, but it also needs to go up as well. I mean, there you can train like the efficiency, how to ride over that route and stuff like that. So,
And I want to ask you some very technical questions as they come into my head, but are there any courses now that you'll ride a hardtail bike, or all the mountain bike courses and the bikes so efficient now that everything's going to be dual suspension bikes?
I think in the men's field it's 99%, it's full suspension. Mm. And there are some, I think some girls are still riding at some courses hardtail, which I don't, for me, I would never ride it.
Mm.
Because we also know that the efficiency from a hardtail, even if you don't see a lot of bumps, it's not never as good as with this full suspension, even when it goes straight over a grass section.
Mm.
It gives you a big advantage with the full suspension. I only have full suspension bike.
Yeah.
How do you've spoken a lot about efficiency. How do you evaluate efficiency after a race, and more generally after a race is finished? Do you watch video of it and look at yourself and try and take the technical tips from it, and then do you add that to your own discussions with your coach around your race pattern, the decisions you made physiologically, how you felt? Like, what does your race evaluation process look like?
It's difficult to find out if you were efficient or not. Like, even without, when you race without the power meter, you can measure it in trainings where you have like technical downhills and uphills, and there you see the time, the power, and which lane you took, and then you can measure it out how efficient it was. In the race you have the videos, and there is, I think it's called on Instagram, How the Race Was Won. I think it's from a guy, and there you see he takes two or three guys next to each other, like Lancer Hyde, it's a good one, with Nino against the second or third guy, and then you just see the lines, and he's not losing one second, and the other guy goes, he bumps over that route, and you can see immediately a difference. So with video, you can do a lot of things.
Yeah, there's that Cosmo Catalano guy. You know that account?
No, but I'm definitely going to follow. That's very interesting. Because I imagine that if you look at Mont Saint-Anne, like you mentioned that one, could you look at that race and say, right, okay, I know I'm looking at my time down that technical section. Nino has gone down there, that section. Oh, I need to. That's where I'm losing a bit of time. And are you as analytical as that in your race, post-race stuff?
Yeah, in the World Cup, it's quite difficult to have like certain downhills the time, because it's not, no time measurement is there in place. So it's quite difficult, but sometimes in Swiss races we do it with timing, so you can see each rider has that time in that section, and you can compare it quite well.
Because I suppose the problem is, like, you'd only ever have the broadcast footage.
Yeah.
And like, the broadcast follows the guy at the bottom of the descent as he leaves the descent to start the next climb.
Mm.
And the guy who's 7 seconds behind him, you never see finish the descent. Mm. You know what I mean?
I was just thinking,
you need a coach. You need a coach.
Well, I was going to say, not have a guy with a video camera videoing sections of the course, so you can compare.
Yeah. Or what I was wondering is, like in a rugby match, there would be 10 cameras, let's say. And you can actually get all 10 cameras feed, because a lot of them are static cameras. It's just the director's choosing what to show you on your television. So I wondered where the cyclists were going to the broadcast and saying, I want the footage from camera 5, which is a static camera on that one section of the race. I don't know.
But I think it's not possible there.
No,
you need to have your own video.
And I suppose, almost like, what's the point? Because let's say it is a longish section and you say, okay, that's the line everyone's taking. Next time we race it, it's not the line everyone's taking, because the conditions are so different. So it's almost like the information, the value of the information expires the moment the race is finished.
I think it's more for yourself. Like, if you see when you measure 5-6 sections, there's a flat section, it's an uphill, it's a downhill in a Swiss race, and you compare it with all the Swiss guys, and you are always the slowest in the downhill, so you know exactly, okay, I have to work a little bit more in that section or type of. And if you always really fast downhill, but in the flat sections, you know, it's more for yourself. Mm. You can't really compare to, this guy is 1 second faster. Maybe he's also taking more risk, you know.
Mm.
It's also something that you need to consider, taking risks.
Mm. So here's an interesting line of questioning, which I've often wanted to ask prior people, and we've discussed this a couple of times in podcasts, and we will one day get a sports psychologist to come and answer some of these questions. But you touched on very briefly about the fact when you're in Stellenbosch, you're training on your own a lot of the time, which again is a challenge. Do you think there is, as a professional athlete, and being honest with yourself, is there a psychosis, in other words, a difference between you and the rest of us in terms of being so determined to go out there and ride every day? In other words, what motivates you to be a top athlete? Because people talk about top athletes being very selfish, being very internally looking, that they have to be that, because if they're not, they can't be competitive. They have to have this clear instinct. In other words, they have to be different from the rest of us.
20 hours a week on the bike.
20 hours a week on the bike. I mean, that takes the average person couldn't do that mentally, because we wouldn't have that motivation. But talk us through what you think it takes to be a top athlete, and is that a healthy obsession, or is it an obsession to be the best?
I think it's an obsession to be the best, but for myself, I want to show it to myself. That's, I think, my motivation to do that whole thing. Not for somebody else. I want to show it to myself. I can be the best guy in the world. That's like my motivation. And also to see the progress. The way to the lead to a race. That's something that's really interesting for me. To see, to get maybe a little bit better every week, and to see that small steps. That's something that's really, I really enjoy.
And do you think you have to be quite selfish being a professional athlete? Or do you think that's unfair?
I think you need to be selfish in some points. Like, you can't, you have to say no to a lot of things. Mm. Like, you can't go out sometimes, you can't drink alcohol in some situations, stuff like that. I think the world know, I think it's quite, it's quite important, but selfish in certain point, I think, yes.
Just give us an idea of what your day is like then. Like, what are you doing and what are you saying no to? Aside from alcohol, you're waking up and you're doing...
I'm saying no to going out for breakfast and eat unhealthy breakfast. And
almond croissant and 2 cups of coffee.
A bit Hollandaise sauce or I don't know. No, but I need to have a plan for the day. Like, I can decide my whole day, but I really, for my head, it's better to have a plan. Like, let's say I start 10 o'clock, I start with my training, and then I also want to go at 10 o'clock, because after, if I don't do it, it's like I'm not feeling nice. So, and the other thing is to say no to go out today evening and having too much wine, when you know exactly tomorrow it's important session, or I don't know, to go on the rest day and you go shopping for the whole day, you know exactly today's rest, you need to maybe relax, have a massage, something. Sometimes I think that's the thing.
So what does that day look like? So you're saying most days 10 o'clock is like your routine, you want to be riding on the bike by 10 o'clock?
A little bit on which time of the year, like winter in Switzerland. You're not going before 10 because it's still dark.
Yes.
And it's cold.
Yeah, whereas in South Africa, if you go at 10.
Now I came with that routine to Stellenbosch, and I'm also starting only at 10. So you're always the only guy that's riding at 10. It's so funny. I don't know why here, but everybody leaves at 6 o'clock. I still don't understand it.
I should have been born in Switzerland. Because my mates, these guys are like 5:30 starts.
That's something so I never understood. Five. I mean, when I wanted to ride with some locals here, we leave at 6. Why at six? Why? But why?
That's, and this is not locals who work. This is local cyclists who.
Yeah, that's.
Because I get it. I mean, like the reason these guys ride so early in the week because they got to pick their kids up, or take their kids to school at 8 o'clock. So you've got to be finished and so on. But I also struggle with the early morning starts. But I think it's just because it's not unique to cycling, right? Like our running events start at 7 in the morning.
Yeah.
People run marathons at 7. You know, in Europe, you'd start at 9:30.
Mm.
We just have a very early morning culture.
Yeah, I know nobody in Switzerland that's right. That even in summer at 6 o'clock, like maybe at 9. That's the earliest. Maybe it's when you do a big loop, a special one once a year, you go at 8 o'clock. I don't know in summer, but never at 6. So what's the reason? Is it the temperature? Sometimes I understand it in February when it's getting 40 degrees. You can't leave at 12 o'clock. Yeah. Maybe that's the one. But
it is a good question. I mean, I know practically from my side, when you've got family at home and that sort of thing, you want to be home early. If you leave at 9, you're only going to get back middle of the afternoon if you're doing a long ride. So there's practical side. But I think there is a cultural thing. But most of the people that we ride with have got families that are at home and waiting for them. So I think a lot of the time it is just a practical way of getting back.
I'm not even joking, and this will be in winter as well, eh?
It's true.
You guys are 5:30 in winter. You finish the ride and it's still dark. It's
still dark.
Yeah. You finish with 30 minutes to go before the sun pops up.
For me, it makes no sense. Yeah. I mean, I want to enjoy it, especially if I'm not a pro, I want to enjoy the ride. And how can you enjoy it when it's dark and cold? That's for me. I will never do it.
No. So in any event, so it's 10 o'clock till 2 o'clock. What's it, 4 hours? Yeah. Three to four hours?
Yeah, I mean, most of the days I do only one session, 3-4 hours, and then you come back, you eat, you do your admin stuff.
Yeah.
Then, yeah.
Are you doing strength work, like weight-related training or body weight?
I really tried now so for so many years, but now actually I stopped to do it, like to do proper straight. Like I do like core stuff, but not crazy gym stuff. I don't know. I'm just, I think, a non-responder to it. Like I tried so hard, and it's especially when you do so much endurance training, I think it's really difficult to gain muscle. It's like counterproductive. Yeah, it's. Given our weight, I think it's still a lot of young guys, and they go to the gym because they see Nino is doing a lot of gym work, and then they think it works as well for them. Mm. But I think so. Everybody's different. So for me, I think it's better without. I prefer to spend maybe one or two hours more on the bike every week instead of going to the gym.
And things like yoga, flexibility work, Pilates, that sort of stuff?
No, not really. But my girlfriend, she always says, do some yoga. But maybe I start now with her. But
you're 29 years, 29, so you're getting old now.
Yeah.
So
you might need to do feel that. My back, my knees. I'm old guy now. No, but yeah.
So there's very little cross training. I mean, you're not doing recovery. You're not doing recovery training. I mean, do you go for walks on off days, or go swimming, or anything like that? I mean, how do you recover? Do you do active recovery, or is it just
training? Recover. I have two small dogs, so we go with them out for walk. Yeah, twice or three times a day.
Mm.
That's kind of, and on rest day. Yeah, I prefer to. I have so much to do, other things, or take an ice bath or something now to go to the Landotno Beach.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your plan from here?
Yeah, I think, I was there 1 week ago and it was so cold, so I had to look it up, and it was, I think it's 12 or 13 degrees. So it's perfect for a...
That's an average day. So we've debated this ice bath thing. I mean, Ross, I mean... Do ice baths actually work? I mean, that's the big... obviously, a lot of top athletes are using them, but
the thing is they work, which might be the problem.
Well, they're not helping you recover, actually, because they're not repairing muscle.
Well, so you were going to say something like, we're not big fans of ice baths.
I listened to some podcasts where you discussed about it, so you're not really into it.
The thing is, there are some things we do that don't have any effect on our bodies.
Mm.
I don't think ice baths is there in terms of not working. So they work. they do what they're supposed to do, which is to reduce inflammation. So that's a benefit. The problem is sometimes you don't want to reduce inflammation, right?
That's exactly why I only do it on maybe on rest days. Exactly. I will never do it after the ride.
Mm.
We would only do it when it's close to an important race, like in World Champs week. We do it after every session because we don't want that inflammation.
Mm.
But during a training session or training camps, actually it's exactly what you said.
Yeah.
So you do it maybe on rest days, but not after every training. Then, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because if the inflammation is part of the message that makes us get better in response to training, in other words, adaptation requires inflammation, then it makes no sense to stop the inflammation.
Mm.
But if the inflammation is detrimental to the next performance, then it makes a lot of sense to stop the inflammation. And there's a point at which that trade-off tilts very strongly in favor of not stopping inflammation, right?
Yeah,
so
I get that.
So, for example, in the rugby sevens, ice bathing on game days, because you're going to play every 3 hours. So immediately after the game one, you want to get the inflammation down as quickly as you can because it means readiness.
But why do you want to get inflammation down? What's the reason?
Because inflammation generally is thought to be detrimental to the next performance. Right. You know, so it's carries pain signals. There's a bit of swelling. The muscle function might be slightly impaired as a consequence.
Okay.
I think you do especially, it's beneficial like a Cape Epic. You race every day.
Exactly.
Again.
Yeah.
So you need to go to the ice spot as quick as possible after the stage.
Exactly. And because in Cape Epic, you're not expecting to get a training benefit from stage 2 to 3 to 4.
No.
Like, you're not there to train. Yeah. You're there to race. So the benefit of stopping inflammation is greater than the downside of stopping it. Whereas outside of a race situation, that's not the case, right? It makes sense.
Yeah.
But the point is that ice baths sometimes aren't good because they work, not because they don't.
I understand, yeah.
Yeah. So
it's good because you actually confirm that's exactly how you're using them. You're using using them in the right way.
Yeah, I think, like, let's say yesterday was the last training. Now it's some hours ago. Today afternoon you do the ice bath and then you feel better for the intensity training that's follows tomorrow. So maybe, or I think for me that's a good way, but I would never do it in that 3 or 4 day block because of the inflammation.
The same is true of other methods to stop inflammation, not just like antioxidants and anti-inflammatories.
Like vitamin C, high dosage and stuff like that.
Yeah. In fact, there's a paper, I think Tommy Lindberg, who's the Swedish guy that's...
Yeah, we've mentioned him a few times.
I think they'd published one recently. Admittedly, it was on resistance training, and it showed that either antioxidants or anti-inflammatories blunted the training response if you use it while you train.
Yeah.
So that's the danger.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
So you touched a bit on the nutrition, I mean, on the vitamin side.
Yeah.
Tell us about what your thoughts are around vitamins, and we'll move on to nutrition.
Generally
as well.
Nutrition, yeah, we'll go that direction.
Yeah.
Like nutrition-wise, yeah, I mean, there was a huge step in the last couple of years with that more intake in carbs.
Mm.
I also asked some questions about it to Ross earlier. My goal is at the moment to have 90 to 100 grams an hour during the race.
During the race?
Yeah.
Even on a short race, like 90 minutes?
Yeah. Especially there, I would have thought.
Yeah.
Because the intensity is so high.
Yeah. Even I think on science, like on paper, it's still not proven that it really is a benefit, like, to have more than 90 grams and stuff. But for sure, it's better to have... than 60 with, like, I think they had a study with, like, runners up the mountains
where
the muscle damage was way lower with more carbs. But you also have to train the gut. You have to use it in training. You can't train low carb and then you put 100 grams an hour into the...
So that's what I was going to say. So, right, it's a four-hour ride.
Yeah.
Are you doing 90 grams per hour for 4 hours every ride?
No, not really. Like,
you pick one or two,
or high intensity trainings. Yeah, you do the same fueling as you would do in a race, but usually I think it was also a big shift. Some years ago, they always said, basic training you can do low carb, and now everybody's or I do and a lot of other guys, they're using high carbs even during low intensity rides, like let's say 50, 60 grams an hour during a 4-hour ride. And I think it gives you, it recovers you faster, and you feel better the next day. You can train more. I think it's beneficial.
That's definitely, there's a couple of studies that show that in a block of even low intensity training, the people who had more carbs recover better, less muscle damage.
Mm.
Yeah.
So even on those training rides, you're doing close to 60 grams an hour, which is quite high, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
that's what
Pro
Road guys are doing.
240 grams.
Yeah.
Where is that coming in the form of just pockets? You took a pocket full of gels?
It depends really. Sometimes I always start something in the bottle, and then you have a bar and a banana, and then you stop at the petrol station, eat something. Mm. Yeah. I'm not measuring it till like 1 gram exactly. More or less around 50, 60 grams.
Hmm.
Yeah.
But on the intensity days, you're actually simulating race nutrition strategies, and
I think it's important to do that.
What does that look like? Because you'd have access to your nutrition. You wouldn't want it on the bike because of the weight, or do you actually say, okay, I'll take 600 grams extra in a bottle on the bike, or do you rather grab something every lap when you can, a gel, and off you go?
Like in training, you mean, or
no, in the race.
In the race, you have that you have the tech zones or like feed zones. So you have every bottle, it's only mixed or with maybe 200 milliliters.
Yeah.
So for the weight, because you drink it, you throw it away, and you measure it that at the end with all that 6 or 7 bottles, it comes up to that amount carbs you want. And then some guys have also a gel in the back pocket that you can take. And I think there's also with caffeine, that's also some drinks are mixed with caffeine as well.
Mm.
When do you take it? Do you take it before, during? Yeah. It's also a big question.
Yeah.
So the caffeine is what you have that you have towards the end of a race, because it gives you that bit of kick.
The thing is,
the race is so short.
I think it takes about 45 minutes to an hour that it's full in the body, caffeine. So, and I always have I struggle a little bit at the start, so I take it before, like almost one hour before the race. Mm. So it's available at the start.
And because that start is so high intensity, said earlier,
sometimes I'm smiling a little bit when you see some guys taking caffeine at the short race at the start, which takes 20 minutes.
Yeah, they'll be ready at the finish line.
Yeah, and then you it's at 7 in the evening, so it's good night.
They can't sleep.
At sometimes.
And how do you? I mean, so when you say you grab those bottles at those feed zones, and we see that happening on television a lot. How are you grabbing and just putting as much of that in your mouth as you can? Or are you drinking the whole bottle? Because it just looks like the guys grab it and they just take a sip and then they throw it away. Are you trying to get as much in as you can at that time in one big gulp? Because you can't take a bottle while you during the rest of the race, can you?
Yeah, you can.
Can you?
Like, mostly I have the bottle in the bike and I take a new one. And then after that, I throw out the old bottle and put in the new one. Because if I miss it, I still have maybe one sip left in the old one. But most of the guys, they do it like that. They take a fresh one, put it in the bike, and then they drink where it's the best to drink.
Okay. Because there never seems a time when you can actually reach down and grab a bottle, because it's always so intense.
But that's...
there is time.
Yeah, that's like a risk of not feeding well. Yeah. Like, you have to think before the race... The days before, when you look at the lab, where can you feed proper? Where is a good time and where not? And then you also have to think about it. When there is no good spot to feed, then it's probably the better thing. You take it at the feed zone, you drink everything and throw it away. Otherwise, you have weight for nothing with you. Mm. So you have to be smart.
Yeah,
sure.
But it is like you have to be so deliberate about it. It's actually quite a cool thing to appreciate, that it's not just I'll drink when I have a chance, it's I'm going to drink because I'm going to make a chance.
Was also now with the new discovery the new World Cup, everything, they have only one feed zone, and then they have two lines. It's more like Formula One, like pit zones. And at the first race in Novo Mesto, the feed zone line was on grass and the main line was on tarmac, so it was quite much faster to take the main line. So we decided not to go in and have, instead taking one full bottle, have maybe a little bit more weight, but lose, instead of losing every lap, you go in 3-4 seconds. And then you can, national coach made some, you can calculate it, how much time you lose with 300 grams more over 90 minutes, or how much time you lose if you go in every lap. So
as opposed to how much time you might lose if you had no nutrition, no energy supply.
Yeah, so, sure.
Yeah, so you got three options, and
it's also some tactics.
Yes,
you have to think about it.
Yeah. It's a bit like Formula One in some respects, because you have to figure out how much time you're going to lose if you're in between.
Yeah, when you change the wheels. So.
Yeah, and you mentioned that this is new. Like 6 years ago, when you sort of left the under 23 world, you were doing 40 grams in a race.
Now you're doing maybe double that. Fix 40, 60 grams max per hour. Yeah, and now it's starting to have 100.
And was it difficult to get up there? Like, did you find gastric problems, or have you managed to adapt quite quickly to it? Because we discussed on this podcast like 6 weeks ago, and we said we're going to be quite deliberate. And I can't get to 60 grams an hour, let alone 100. My stomach is.
I think it really depends which product you use, or if you need to use the right product. Yeah. I think it's not working when you have not that ratio 1 to 0.8.
That is the key. Like
glucose to fructose. That's something I'm really interested in. Like, and I still don't know how to measure it. That you can find out with which product
delivers
you the most actually in your blood. It's not just. I mean, you can drink 2 liters of it, but you don't know how much it really delivers at the end in your muscles. That's something that's really would be really nice to measure it, and then you can exactly see maybe this product is better than this and this, especially for you.
Yeah,
and that would be it.
I mean, do you have different product sponsors that you have to use their product, or can you choose whatever you want to?
No, we have Wu, like it's a Swiss product, but they specially made after our request that ratio with 1 to 0.8, so it's up to the highest standards now.
So you believe you're using the best stuff?
It's the best stuff. No, but it's good.
Yeah.
But yeah, you really need that ratio. Otherwise, it's not going to work. Just put more stuff in, then you have problems.
And just coming back to your easy rides then, you're doing the 60 grams an hour then on those as well. And what's the intensity of those rides relative to your high intensity stuff? Is it?
It's about like 200 watts. 200 watts.
What's that, like zone 2 kind of thing?
So zone 2, yes. Mm. But that in that basic rides, I also look more on the heart rate as well. Okay. It's like a big range from. In my case, it's from 120 to 140. That's my range. And I look at that and compare it with the power. So I'm always in that range.
And you've noticed the recovery benefit of that additional carb and in those easy rides.
I think it's a key.
Yeah.
Especially when you have big blocks of training. Then you come home after 5 hours and you still are right off. And before, some years ago, you were totally destroyed after like... Yeah, not eating the first. It was always not eating the first 2 hours, and after that you can eat something. It's stupid.
Off the bike nutrition. I mean, are you? Because I gather you're quite deliberate about your nutrition. So what do you do before and after a ride?
In the morning, I have proteins and carbs, some eggs, oats or bread. I'm not crazy, I'm not waiting stuffers or anything like that. And I'm also, just a healthy balance, I guess. That's my my key.
And so none of these extreme diets that people
Not really. And I don't know what my body is. If I'm close to top shape and or if I'm in top shape, the body weight drops automatically. I'm not like not eating anymore or stuff like that. It's automatic. I don't know. So maybe I'm lucky a little bit, but I'm not like extreme. And
so now when you're not in race weight, you're about what, 72 kilograms?
Now I'm about like 70 kilos. 71.
And then in race weight, you're 67, yeah, 66?
Yeah, around that.
Okay.
But yeah, it's definitely not healthy to be always around that, especially not in winter and when it's cold and then you get virus and stuff like that. So it's beneficial to have some more kilos, I think, in winter time. It's not
bad. But your winter time in Europe, in other words, yeah, summer in South Africa.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a good thing about South Africa. That's like summer here, direct flights, no jet lag. I mean, that's always stable. The weather is always good. In summer.
Yeah.
I think I heard you had some big rains in winter.
Yeah, rains a lot in winter, yeah.
That's true. Marcel, thanks very much. I mean, it's been a fascinating chat to you, and best of luck for the rest of you. Just give us an idea of what your year looks like. Obviously, you've got the World Cups, but what is your main focus this year? I mean, obviously, we know it must be Paris.
Yeah, main focus is to qualify for Paris. That's the main focus, and for there, the first two World Cups are really important in Brazil. So we do everything we can to deliver there. With heat adaptation, that's also will be key there because it's warm, and from Europe you're coming out of winter, so I will be staying in Stellenbosch as long as possible. And after that, hopefully Paris, and for sure the whole World Cups, the races, and the World Champs in Andorra. It's also a different one. It's in altitude. It's 2,000 meters. So, sure. It will be interesting year this season. It's coming up.
What's the qualification process for the Swiss team? Will it be based purely on world rankings?
No, that's the thing. I spoke with.
We were talking about this before you. Podcast.
I think it's that they can consider it. That you can go, it's a top five, which I did, but that's
top
only
the World Cup,
Cup top five. Yeah. But that's only two spots, and four or five other guys also did it. So we have only two spots, and to be realistic, you need to win a World Cup to go. There's with Lars, with Matthias and Nino, there's three that won a World Cup, and two other guys with the top five. So in Brazil you almost need to win, I think.
Just an unbelievable depth in Swiss cycling. I mean, every one of you top five guys can win World Cups, whereas...
Because two slots per country at the Olympics.
Yeah, they drop it down from three to two now. It's aggressive. I don't know why.
What's it at the World Championships?
It's at Worlds, it's seven plus the World Champion. But now we lost Nino as a world champion, so we only have seven spots. But that's kind of seven. It's kind of good. It's still difficult to go there as a Swiss guy because there are seven, eight, nine guys that they can ride top 10.
Mm.
But Olympics, it's ridiculous.
Spots. Because remember the women got the full podium in Tokyo. It's so that's no longer going to be possible.
It's not going to happen anymore.
I don't know that they've done that.
Imagine just having that bit of history on your side and you know nobody's going to do that again. It's incredible. I mean, the Swiss men could do that. There's no doubt you guys could get top three.
We could, but not anymore. Yeah. I think they're not changing it to get three spots. But because of Brazil, Paris and in Brazil, it will be warm. So it's going to be... important to that whole.
Do you have an indication yet of what the Paris route will look like?
There was a test event last summer. I didn't go, but there was a race on it. We have footage, everything. It looks like it's a fast course. A lot of gravel sections, some artificial like rocks and stuff. It's not like
not like a classic. It's
It's not like a classic
Classic natural mountainous.
No, but And also with Andorra, that's world champs in altitude. It's also...
That'll be something.
Yeah, you need to be prepared. That's also... I was listening to your podcast in before Andorra this year. It was a World Cup. And then you said, yeah, it's no chance if you're not... if you're not going up there,
and you're gonna get up as early as you can.
I didn't go up, but then I still finished like 13th. But maybe it's just that the difference, not top five to top 10.
It's, so what you're saying, if you'd taken Ross's advice, you would have got top five.
Maybe, yeah, maybe.
You get up there really early this year. When is World Champs? Must be 5 or 6 weeks after the Olympics. No, it'll be late longer, right?
August, I think. August, middle, something.
That's about
like
a month.
That's about a month then.
Yeah.
It's a quick transition one big race to another.
Yeah. It'll
be an opportunity there for some.
It could be a big opportunity if you're not going to Olympics and prepare well for Andorra altitude. That's some of the guys, they're not motivated after Olympics anymore.
Yeah.
But I think it's crucial to go and adapt to the altitude for worlds when it's on 2,000 meters.
And then further beyond, I mean, like, you're a local South African now, so you've got to ride the Epic at some stage.
Yeah, I will, maybe with you often.
if you agree to do the whole thing in your zone 2 power output, I think I can do it.
No, definitely we want to do it also with the team once. But we decided not to do it this year because of the Olympic season and everything, and we never did it, but it's in my mind, and I mean I know probably half or more of the route, so it would be a home race for me, as I would say. So one day for sure.
Yeah, and then the other one's in your other home.
Yeah, Swiss Epic.
You can bag two of them at home.
That's a bit shorter, the Swiss Epic,
much more climbing. Yeah,
That's right. Yeah, for sure.
I think
for
they say it's physically it's harder than the Cape Epic because of the climbing.
That's what they say.
I think the Cape Epic is because of the heat and
If you get a hot year here, man, some of those are brutal. Wasn't this year so bad?
This year I was muddy. I saw some picture. Yeah. They walked.
There were some muddy days, but there's been a couple of years ago.
It's so hot. You get third of the race in the medical tent afterwards. Yeah.
And they cut the race, the stages short because of the heat sometimes, and it's quite intense. Yeah. We look forward to seeing you. So Marcel, we look forward to seeing you for the rest of the year. I know I'm going to be watching your progress throughout the year on the World Cups and hopefully the Paris Olympics and the World Cup, the World Championships, with a great deal of interest. So thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks. Thank you. It was nice.
You have been listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on X, Facebook, Instagram, and join the conversation on our exclusive Science of Sport Patreon page.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.